This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. Our guest this morning is Casey Golden, Policy Director for Climate Solutions, a Washington State-based nonprofit seeking to accelerate practical and profitable solutions to global warming. From 1999 to 2002, Casey was a special assistant to the Mayor of Seattle for Clean Energy and Climate Protection Initiatives. In that capacity, he helped to engineer Seattle City Light's commitment to become the nation's first climate-neutral electric power utility and the city's commitment to exceed the goals of the Kyoto Protocol. Casey Golden is here today to give us an update on where we stand in our efforts to fight global warming and how we need to proceed to prevent catastrophic climate change. Welcome, Casey.
Thanks, Diane. Thanks for having me.
In terms of the most recent science, how close are we to levels of carbon in the atmosphere that put us at risk for catastrophic climate change?
Well, we're definitely getting close to the red zone. It's definitely not too early to be accelerating our efforts at solutions. The scientists say that the line that we should really avoid is increases of 2 degrees Fahrenheit in the global average temperature beyond where we are now. And of course, there's sort of momentum in the system. So the temperature's been building for a while. It will continue to build even as we turn ourselves more enthusiastically toward solutions. And avoiding that 2 degree threshold is going to be a big challenge. That's the threshold at which scientists say you start to experience negative feedback loops and other things that drive the climate into sort of uncontrollable catastrophes. The good news, however, is that it's pretty clear that with an aggressive, global, ambitious, full-tilt clean energy revolution, we can stay on the right side of that 2 degree line. But we sure don't have any time to lose.
What are the trends in greenhouse gas emissions worldwide over the past few years?
Well, you know, with the economic situation, you're starting to see a little bit of a blip of slowdown, but for the most part, they've continued to increase apace, driven primarily now by the growth of developing economies who are just really starting to see their economies take off and the increase in fossil fuel consumption in those economies. People aspiring to and emulating the kind of prosperity that we've enjoyed in the U.S., which is a fossil-fueled prosperity. And that kind of prosperity isn't sustainable anymore for us or for them. So the challenge now is to develop a new sustainable prosperity that both works for us and a lot of other people who aspire to what we have.
Looking at the U.S. specifically, what have been our trends in greenhouse gas emissions compared to the world as a whole?
They're still up. The last year or two have been somewhere in the neighborhood of steady. It's always hard in any one year to net out all the different things that are going on. It's clear that we reduced our oil consumption last year when gas prices were high, quite significantly, by on the order of 6%. That is a great one-year phenomenon, but it was clearly driven by the spike in gas prices. And the interesting thing will be to see now that gas prices are down, whether we forget the lesson and whether we go back to the levels of oil consumption that we were at before, or whether we engineer some lasting changes.
Right now, in 2008, what fraction of the world's total greenhouse gas emissions are being emitted by the U.S.?
About a quarter. And there's some very interesting work being done internationally. Actually, the nations of the world are meeting for the annual International Climate Treaty meeting as we speak here today. They're in Poland on the last meeting under the Kyoto Protocol. Next year in Copenhagen, they expect to negotiate a new treaty that will succeed the Kyoto Protocol. But one of the things that's most hotly debated is, what is the responsibility of the developed world, the relatively rich world, to engineer solutions? And your question about what our proportion of emissions is, that's an important part of determining what our responsibility is. Most of the formulas they're using for determining responsibility and capability to invest in solutions actually put us closer to 30 to 35% of the total responsibility and capability is in the United States. And those two things are a function of not just our emissions today, but our historic emissions, because all of the emissions that we've produced in the last 100 years are still up there and still warming the planet, and also a function of our relative wealth relative to the rest of the world. And if you take those both into effect, roughly a third of the responsibility for investing in and engineering solutions is right here in the U.S.
How much time do we have, given the current trends, before we face catastrophic climate change, if we weren't to change from what we're emitting today?
You know, catastrophic, I suppose, is in the eye of the beholder. Last fall, at about this time, we had the second 100-year flood we've had in the last 5 years right here in Washington State, along with a very intense windstorm that took down thousands and thousands of acres of trees in southwest Washington, flooded I-5 and cut off I-5. The kinds of increases we've seen on every continent in the last 40 to 50 years in extreme flooding and weather events are very, very pronounced. So fires, extreme floods, Katrina-like events, those things are already happening. The trend in the Arctic ice, which is kind of a thermometer or a barometer of what's happening to the whole planet, are really taking the scientists by surprise. It used to be they'd say, you know, in their most dire projections that the Arctic ice would be gone in 20 or 30 years. Now it looks like in the summer it'll be gone within the next 5. So a lot of these trends are happening much quicker than the scientists predicted. And in a way, that's what you would anticipate if you think about how science works. When scientists all get together and try to come to a consensus, their incentive and their instinct is not to all agree. That's not how scientists succeed. Scientists succeed by disagreeing and writing papers that challenge different theories. The fact that they all agreed on what's going on with the climate system suggests that the debate really is quite over, and in fact, the physical phenomenon are moving along faster than the scientists were willing to predict because they're inherently conservative in their collective opinions. So we definitely are seeing the problem accelerate at a growing rate, and it's already very, very costly.
Would you review which human activities are most responsible for driving the increase in greenhouse gas emissions?
The biggest by far is fossil fuel consumption, fossil fuel combustion, coal, oil, gas. And the other really big important one is deforestation, particularly in the tropical countries. The loss of the forest carbon storage in the tropical world, also soils to some extent that have stored carbon for millennia, is a big driver of global emissions. For us in the developed world, leading a relatively comfortable lifestyle compared to most of the world, it's the fossil fuel consumption, which means our transportation and energy systems. And it's also consumption in general and how much we consume and how we deal with waste. The whole cycle of production of material goods, consumption of material goods, and disposal of material goods has a lot of emissions associated with it. Some of them are fossil fuel emissions used to produce these goods. Some of them are landfill emissions when we dispose of the goods in landfills. But one of the big opportunities for reducing our emissions is by consuming less and managing what we consume and disposing of what we consume in a better way, recycling more, reusing more.
Based on the current science, what are the necessary reductions in carbon emissions needed and with what timeline to prevent catastrophic climate change?
At least 80, probably more like 90% below 1990 levels by 2050. Is what keeps us below that 2-degree threshold. And when we talk about 2050 numbers, those are the things that are sort of easiest to understand in the context of a scientific climate model. That date's pretty far out there from a political perspective or from an action perspective. I think the important debate in Congress now and in the international negotiations is about the 2020 target. And last year at this time at the international meeting, the target that was agreed to for the developed world, for countries like the U.S., was from 25 to 40% below 1990 levels by 2020. To give you context, the most aggressive bills in Congress now are on the order of just getting our emissions back to 1990 levels by 2020. So we still got to dig a lot deeper than so far our elected leaders have been willing to dig to reduce these emissions.
What reduction would you personally recommend for 2020?
What the scientists say we need to do to avoid catastrophic disruption. So I think what they came to in Bali at the last international meeting is what we should be aspiring to, both because it's backed out of the best science we have. It's, as far as we can tell with our best scientific tools, what nature is telling us is necessary. And nature, of course, isn't running for anything, and she's not negotiating with anyone. She's just telling us how it is. So that's the scientific answer. It's also, very importantly, the international diplomatic answer. There is no national or state or local solution to global warming in the absence of a global commitment. What we're doing at the state and local and national level is critically important, especially to the rest of the world, which has grown somewhat discouraged about the lack of U.S. action at the national level. So what we do in our own communities is absolutely essential. But of course, in order for it to work in the end, we have to have a good global deal. And that 25 to 40% below 1990 levels by 2020 is what emerged from the international negotiations, and that's where we should go.
I'm Diane Horn, and we are speaking with Casey Golden, Policy Director for Climate Solutions. Our topic is where we stand in our efforts to fight global warming and how we need to proceed to prevent catastrophic climate change. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. What do you see as the most effective steps that have been taken to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions so far?
Yeah, I'm really glad to begin this part of the discussion because, you know, when we talk about the science, it sounds sort of big and remote and hard to figure out where to put your lever to really start to change things. And the truth is, the most important part of the solution to global warming is the clean energy revolution that we need to have for so many other reasons. We need to have it for national security reasons. We need to have it for economic reasons. You know, we're beginning this huge new process of public intervention to recover the economy. But the economy is like a bucket with giant holes in the bottom. And that's the fossil fuels that we consume, the money we pour into our economic bucket that just leaks out the bottom and goes to Houston or Riyadh or wherever it goes to import fossil fuels, but straight out of our local economies. So this business of ending our fossil fuel addiction, of waging this clean energy revolution, is what we desperately need to save the climate. But it's also the single most productive thing we can do to re-engineer our economy and our prosperity so that it can actually work and it can actually last. You know, the best example right now that's on everybody's mind is this GM bailout or the big three auto bailout. Are we just going to throw money at the same old dying jalopy, or are we going to use this opportunity to leverage a historic public intervention that gives us the automotive revolution we need to actually solve these problems? That's a really fateful choice, and we're making it right now in the context of the economic recovery. So when you ask about what are the most effective things we've done and that we can do, far and away without exception, it's changing our energy system to reduce our reliance on fossil fuels. So what does that look like in a local context? It means more efficient buildings and appliances in all of our daily lives, in our offices, in our homes, in our industries, which also reduce our energy costs. And overwhelmingly in the Puget Sound region where most of your listeners are, it means alternatives to getting in your car alone to get yourself from point A to point B. And we've been, to be honest, I think too slow in investing in those alternatives. We're starting to see some of them become available. We'll have Sound Transit available next year. We're starting to get better bus service. But it's still true that, you know, I think most folks are ready and eager to get out of their cars, but oftentimes don't have something good to get into to get them where they need to go. So making those investments collectively and then making those choices individually to use alternatives to cars, that's probably the single biggest part of the solution that somebody in the Puget Sound can do today.
To what extent has the Kyoto Agreement been helpful?
Well, I think it's been very helpful because, you know, we were just talking about local action. And I think everyone knows that it's the right thing to do to screw in those compact fluorescent light bulbs and choose alternatives to getting in your car. But that's only really hopeful. It's only really effective in the context of a global campaign for solutions. And that's what Kyoto is, a global campaign for solutions. It's certainly not everything we need to solve the problem, but it has been a steady drumbeat of mutual commitment among the nations of the world to play our respective roles in what must be a global campaign. That mutual commitment needs to be strengthened, it needs to be accelerated, and above all, it needs to have the full and enthusiastic participation of the world's largest emitter, the U.S., which it hasn't had up until now. Insofar as Kyoto has fallen short, its biggest single problem is that the biggest polluter has been standing on the sidelines with their arms folded. And when I say that, I mean our federal representatives in the international negotiations. It's been an international embarrassment. It's appalling what the U.S. has done to undermine those negotiations. But at the same time, in communities like Seattle, in states like Washington and the West Coast states, we've been moving ahead with solutions despite our federal government's unwillingness to be part of the solution. And the rest of the world has heard that. Kyoto would not have happened. It would not have gone into effect if we didn't start bringing the mayors and the governors and the civic society and nonprofits to the international negotiations to show the rest of the world a different face of America, a face of America that really is determined to be part of the solution. And that allowed the international negotiations to continue to proceed. The rest of the world would have given up on America if it wasn't for the Seattles and the Washingtons and the Californias saying that we were determined to be part of the answer, even when our federal government was saying something very different. So that sustained us for a lot of years in those international negotiations and kept Kyoto alive. But now, thank heavens, we appear to have elected a president and a new administration that's determined to join with the world community. And they need that sign from us this week in Poland and next year in Copenhagen in order for the international work to continue to move ahead.
Could you elaborate on how well the Obama administration and the new Congress are likely to help us move forward in our steps to address climate change?
Well, I think the signs are really positive. The Obama administration has clearly demonstrated not only that they understand what peril we're in from a climate perspective, but that they understand the opportunity that comes with green redevelopment of our economy and an economic recovery strategy based on solutions to fossil fuel dependence and global warming. President-elect Obama said that, you know, when you look around at what's going to drive an economic recovery, you always need to invest in a new source of prosperity. You can't just patch the old way of doing things. And the single most promising new driver for prosperity is the new energy economy. Those are Obama's words. And I think they're formulating those plans right now. It's a little hard to predict exactly what will come out of the new Congress, but I think that all signs point to a new and very encouraging national understanding that economic recovery and climate solutions are inextricably linked, and that we should take this opportunity to rebuild our economy and rebuild it for a prosperity that can last and a prosperity that solves the global warming crisis.
Cap and trade has been talked about a lot as one of the solutions to our crisis. And I was wondering your view of cap and trade.
Well, let's pick those words apart. You say them, and they have come to be sort of welded together almost as one word. Let's start with cap. What is a cap? A cap is a firm, legal, quantitative commitment to reduce our global warming pollution and to reduce our fossil fuel dependence. We need that commitment. You know, after how many decades of presidents telling us that we're going to do something about our fossil fuel addiction and palliatives and short-term measures and half answers that really haven't helped solve the problem. Are we finally going to get a real enforceable declining commitment with a schedule and a timetable to reduce our fossil fuel dependence? That's what a cap is. So we absolutely need a cap. Now, once we engineer a real cap, then what are we going to do to achieve the cap and to tune the economy to the achievement of the cap so that we continue to generate prosperity and jobs while reducing our emissions and fulfilling this commitment? Emission trading, we call it cap and invest, but this idea that you'd have tradable pollution permits under the cap is one way of achieving the cap, reducing the cost of achieving the cap, and generating private investment in solutions. But it's one among many ways. A carbon tax would do many of the same things. Energy efficiency standards, better fuel efficiency standards for our cars is an absolute necessity, and that will help tune the economy to the achievement of the cap. Renewable resource requirements like our Initiative 937 here in Washington, the Clean Energy Initiative, which, by the way, is under attack in the legislature this year. Those kind of things help tune the economy to the achievement of the cap. But I think the first and foremost question is, how can we get a really solid commitment to do what is right and necessary to solve the climate problem and to reduce our fossil fuel dependence? And the cap is the key to that. I think the cap and invest or cap and trade portion of it can work if it's done right. And if it's not done right, it can be a disaster. So our challenge now in this year's legislature in Washington and Oregon is going to be to put in place a cap and invest system under the Western Climate Initiative, which is part of a 7-state effort that is fair. And by that, I mean the right to pollute should not be given away for free. It should be auctioned off. Polluters should pay. The proceeds should be invested in ways that first and foremost protect the most vulnerable consumers. And second, invest in our transition to a clean energy economy. And it should be as simple and free of loopholes as possible. You know, as you can imagine, a big, important tectonic change in our economy like this, there's going to be a lot of lobbyists lined up with a lot of ideas about how to get around the policy or how to reduce its effectiveness or how to carve aside a loophole for their particular economic interest. And you expect that in a pluralistic system, but this policy is not going to work if we load it down with too many complicated and counterproductive loopholes. So minimize the loopholes, make it fair, polluters pay, invest the proceeds. A cap and trade policy like that can really work and really generate results. And I guess the thing I want to emphasize is, you know, our state legislature doesn't have a lot of money to play around with. They're in a very, very deep budget hole this year. So they're going to be allocating pain among a lot of worthy public enterprises. We need some public investment in the clean energy revolution. But the biggest driver, the biggest source of money for the clean energy revolution is the money you pay every month to your utility, the money you pay when you go to the gas pump. That private money that goes from your pocket into the energy economy, and most of that never goes to a government. That's the money that we have to turn away from the problem and towards solutions. And that's why these cap and invest kind of policies or carbon taxes and others are so critically important to get that private money moving away from the problem and toward the solutions.
You are listening to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Casey Golden, Policy Director for Climate Solutions. Our topic is where we stand in our efforts to fight global warming and how we need to proceed to prevent catastrophic climate change. What would you say to those who claim that the solutions that we've been talking about, we don't really have time for those to develop and we need something much more drastic?
You know, I wouldn't argue with anybody who says that we need to move as fast as we possibly can. There's a wonderful study done. People can look it up. If you have a mind for some wonky stuff on the web, there's a study called Stabilization Wedges that basically shows how you could do what we need to do by scaling up known technologies to full commercial scale. So for instance, if we had 2 billion cars in the world, which is probably what we'll have in 2050, that got 60 miles to the gallon instead of 30, you'd have one of the 7 wedges that you need in order to solve the problem. Well, 60-mile-a-gallon cars is well within what we know how to do now. I guess what I'd say to those people is we have to start acting like it's an emergency, because it is. We have to radically and quickly do the things that we know how to do to solve this problem. So if people are frustrated that we're not doing that urgently enough, they're right. We need to declare that emergency and fully deploy everything we know how to do. And we need to continue to advance new energy technologies, particularly in the area of solar and energy storage and others that are going to help us do it even better. But many of the things that we need to do, we know how to do, and we're just not doing urgently enough.
How do you see bringing society to a better sense of emergency so that we can move faster?
Well, what an interesting question. To be honest, I think it will be the combination of some focusing external events. You know, unfortunately, we are loading the dice right now for more Katrinas, potentially more 9/11s. 9/11 certainly had its roots in our fossil fuel dependence and our relationship to the fossil fuel exporting parts of the world. And, you know, sadly and tragically, we have already loaded the dice for more emergencies like that. The question is, how do we respond when we have those emergencies, those focusing moments that where it's possible to change the rules of politics as usual and all get together and say, you know what, we need to drop our worn out ideological and political constraints and divisions and do something big and urgent and important together. Our generation, I'm pushing 50. A lot of your listeners are probably a lot younger, but even my generation we've never really had the experience of what is it like to pull together as a society and do something big and urgent and important together. The model that we always hearken back to is World War II. And we had a terrible focusing event. We had extraordinary presidential leadership. I think those two things coming together at the same time are part of what it takes. And part of it is us as a society learning to understand and hear and play our roles in a collective story, a collective narrative about who we are and what our defining challenges are and how we're going to respond. We don't have a lot of practice at that. That's going to be something new for us, but we're going to have to figure out how to do it. And, you know, one of the tragedies of the last 8 years is we had focusing moments like that, moments where we were all scared to death, where we were all looking around at each other and saying, what are we going to do in response to this terrible tragedy? And what did we hear from our president? Did we hear, we have nothing to fear but fear itself? No, we heard, go to the mall, or you're doing a great job, Brownie. Those are terribly deflating experiences. And I think the next time that something scary at that scale happens, I think we're going to hear a very different kind of call from our president. And we're going to need that in order to get together and really tackle this challenge at the level of the problem.
Well, you've alluded to this a bit earlier, but how do you see the economic downturn affecting our efforts to combat climate change?
It all depends on us. You know, as President-elect Obama said, it's about how we respond. It's possible that we will reduce our expectations for climate solutions and pull back because we think that it's a time of economic constraint and we can't afford to invest in solutions. That would be exactly the wrong response and an incredibly short-sighted response. I mean, it was amazing how quickly Congress came together and threw $700 billion at the financial industry. $2,000 from every American went to this undefined, changing bailout of the financial industry. So it's clear that we can invest at scale when we decide that it's an emergency. And so part of it is just deciding that climate and fossil fuel dependence are the emergency that they in fact are, and mobilizing our resources accordingly. I think the economic downturn is telling us something. It's telling us that the economy and the form of prosperity that we have built is fundamentally broken. We were floating along on bubbles of cheap debt and cheap fossil fuels, easy credit for a long time, and now those bubbles have popped. And the question in front of us and in front of Congress this very moment as they engineer this auto bailout is, are you going to just lubricate the same old, decrepit, broken, bankrupt economic machinery that got us to this point so that it can hurtle somewhat more efficiently over the cliff that it's falling over? Or are we going to take this opportunity to fundamentally think how we produce goods and services and prosperity in this country? And there's no better place to start than the automotive companies. I mean, the price of this bailout ought to be a full-scale automotive revolution. And we've never had more leverage or ability to do that because of the economic crisis. The usual rules of political constraint and political engagement are being suspended, and we're getting together to do something big. Now the question is it going to be something that works, or is it just going to be throwing good money after bad?
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
We are all the solution. I had Thanksgiving with a young man who's in college right now, and he described to me the night of the election and what happened on the campus when everybody poured out of their dorms and libraries in elation with a new sense of possibility about what we can do together. I remember I was in college in 1980 when Ronald Reagan was elected, and I was on a campus. I was on the Berkeley campus, a campus that Governor Reagan had tear gassed, and we poured out of our dorms and libraries that night in a very different spirit. And I thought about, God, what a great thing to be growing up now and to have your first sort of moment of real political consciousness be this moment of extraordinary opening, this moment of extraordinary possibility. And I guess the message I would leave us with is, let's not look at this economic downturn as a message that we need to reduce our aspirations, reduce our hopes, constrain our ideas about what kind of world we can build together. The economic downturn is a sign that it's urgently necessary, that we need to build a very different world together. And we should be very ambitious and impatient and determined about setting forth to do just that right now.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Casey.
Thank you, Diana. Pleasure.
We have just been speaking with Casey Golden, Policy Director for Climate Solutions. For more information, check on the web at www.climatesolutions.org. Again, that's climatesolutions.org. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and KEXP.org.